all of a sudden said, "Hey, coach, Mendez is not here." I said, "What? Mendez isn't on the bus." And we're an hour down the road.
Sure. Gone.
I left the wire at a truck stop in the middle of nowhere. And I never lived that down.
Yeah.
From that day on, people go, "Why do you always call the names of the players every time we get back on the bus?" I didn't want to lose one. The highlight of my career, 46 years of coaching, was last February when they had my retirement thing for me, surprised me. I had 150 players show up for that. And that's the highlight of my career. That's the value of coaching. High school coaches and college coaches, you will experience that same thing. And that is very worthwhile.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, welcome back to our show, and thank you guys for joining in on the conversation. Releasing this show on October 31st, and we're wishing everyone out there a very happy Halloween to each and every one of you listening in, especially if you have young ones at home, and we'll be hitting the streets tonight to scoop up and stock up for your yearly candy stash. But first, we have to get this right. I love our music, but we need a little Halloween flavor inside this week's show. I got it. Hold on real quick. Get that right there, and... that'll take you back, huh? If you can't get down on the Monster Mash with us, then maybe you and I weren't meant to be friends. That's some good stuff right there, okay? Now we got it going. Thanks again for checking in on this week's show, and we've got a tremendous interview coming your way as we connect with another legendary figure inside our game. We go extra innings with Mark Marquess from Stanford, but first, we want to make sure that each of you listening in, you've already signed up to become part of your baseball coaches fraternity here at the ABCA, and we're trending towards over 10,000 coaches worldwide. It's amazing to become members this year, and we want to make sure you're in the fold with us. Plus, once you do, you'll have access to our granddaddy of them all, our annual ABCA convention. And this year, on January 4th through the 7th, we're going to head out to Indianapolis to welcome coaches from all over the world and across every single level inside our game for 4 days of baseball heaven. Coaching clinics at every turn, the world's largest baseball trade show, over 300 exhibitors, divisional meetings, our Hall of Fame banquet, and the opportunity to network with over 6,000 coaches. And if you're into personal and professional growth, plus you want the ultimate battery recharger to kick off 2018, you find a way to get to Indy and join us for the show. More info on that is going to be at the end for you guys, which brings us to today's episode. And this marks our third installment of our extra inning show, where we open up the airways for the true legends inside baseball. And every single one of us, 100%, I'm a no doubter on this point. When you think of Stanford baseball, who do you see? No disrespect to any players or former coaches, but a spade is a spade. We all see Coach Mark Marquess, who spent 41 years roaming the dugouts as the head coach of the Cardinal, and what a fantastic job he did putting Stanford on the college baseball map over his illustrious career. Now, you're going to hear Coach Marquess like you've never heard him before as we dive deep into his journey wearing Cardinal red as a player, as an assistant coach, and then as head coach, winning a lot of games, making 25 regional appearances, 15 trips to Omaha, and raising the expectation level over his career. But Mark never lost sight of his real mission in coaching, and that was impacting lives and growing up young men. Now, we reflect back on his growth as a coach, his thoughts on the current climate in recruiting and specialization. Plus, we even get Coach Marquess chuckling a few times with some great stories from his time there at Stanford. It was an honor to connect with one of my true idols in college baseball. So let's not waste another second. Let's all jump on and go extra innings with the legendary two-time national champion. We have over 1,600 wins on the call, and I didn't contribute very many of those to an ABCA Hall of Famer. Mark Marquess from Stanford University is our guest on today's episode. And get ready, coaches. This great show is coming at you right now.
From my laboratory in the castle east, the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode.
Coaches, thanks for dialing into the podcast today. We're bringing you an extra innings episode where we connect with the legends inside of baseball, and we've got a great one on deck for you today. We're talking with the retired former head coach at Stanford University, the great Mark Marquess. Coach Marquess, thanks for being on the call with us today.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Absolutely. And we're looking forward to talking through a number of different things that we've got a variety of topics. But where we want to start, for those of you that don't know, coming into Indianapolis this January, Mark is going to receive the Dave Kalitz Ethics and Coaching Award at our convention. I know you're excited about that as a former ABCA Hall of Famer and obviously your contributions to the game. Can you talk about what that award's going to mean to you, but more importantly, what the ABCA has meant to you over the years?
Well, the award is very special to me because I've known and a good friend of Dave Kalitz for a number of years. And in fact, we were on certainly on the NCAA committee and we roomed together 100 years ago. And mm-hmm. so he was a great coach in his own right. And what he's really done, what he really did with the ABCA, really brought it along. So that award is very special to me, and I'm really looking forward to it, especially after Dave Kalitz, who was a great baseball guy, and really the did wonders for the ABCA. As far as the ABCA is concerned, as a young coach and assistant, Ray Young, who was my head coach, and actually Dutch Farring, who's in the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
legendary coach.
Yeah.
And I played for Dutch 1 year, and he made sure that I went to the ABCA and got involved in that. And in fact, Dutch got me involved in USA Baseball. But I think the great thing about the ABCA was just growing. It brought coaches together. And I think initially it was just the college coaches. But when we included the high school coaches, it even made it that much better. And I think the key for it is the learning experience from coach to coach. One of the things that baseball coaches don't do is compared maybe to football or basketball. They're not afraid to share the knowledge. You know, they're not afraid to give you this play or that play that may help you. You go to convention and you listen to the speakers and then you're having dinner or you're having lunch or you're just sitting in the lobby talking. It's a great educational experience for coaches, not only the X's and O's, but how they handle their players and everything else. So ABCA has done so much for the college game. They were instrumental and Dave Kalitz and a lot of people in the GEC committee were very involved in getting college baseball exposure on ESPN and televised and mm-hmm. the regionals. And I know up until 1996, the Olympics in 96 and 92, those players came from the college ranks until it was opened up to all professionals. So that was also the source of getting those players into the USA training site in the Olympics. So the ABCA has just been a tremendous boom for college baseball and high school baseball. And it's gotten better each year. And again, it's a very special organization and really, really one of the better coaching associations in the country.
That's outstanding. I think two points jump out from that, Mark, if I could. One is to your point of the sharing community that we are. We always talk about on this show, baseball coaches will share everything with you, but we won't give you our signs. But we'll tell you exactly how we run first and thirds. We'll break it all down for you. We just won't give you the real nuts and bolts.
If you've coached long enough as I have, or Coach Gillespie, who's not Irvine, they probably know our signs anyway because we haven't changed them that much.
Exactly. So
for sure, absolutely right.
that is dead on. You made another point in there that I thought was really interesting, and I've heard this so much on the podcast, I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to really accentuate the point. Is that majority of guys that get into the ABCA and get passionate about the ABCA, there was a mentor or someone along the way that grabbed them and brought them into the fold. And I think that describes the fraternity feel that we talk about here in the national office is you just don't realize your sphere of influence that you can bring those guys into the ABCA. And who knows, maybe 30 years from now, they're on this podcast saying, you remember that time that Mark brought me to ABCA and I've been passionate about him ever since. I think that is a huge point that we can't walk away from.
Well, it is. And I think that's the thing that makes the association so successful is that fraternity of college coaches initially, but now college and high school coaches, which is really amateur coaches. And I think that's our mission is different than professional coaches. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just a different mission.
Right.
And to share that knowledge with, and a lot of times, as a college coach, I'd learn a lot from high school coaches and how they would do things. So it's a sharing of information, and it's a very special relationship.
That's awesome. Well, we want to talk through your career path in baseball, and I'm going to give some numbers just to kind of accentuate the point here, guys, of who we're talking and dealing with. We've got over 1,600 wins on the Division I level, 41 years as the head coach there at Stanford. I don't know of Stanford baseball without Coach Marquess, which you've done inside of college baseball. Two-time national champion, 15 World Series appearances, and 25 regionals. And again, I know that deep inside you, man, you just bleed Cardinal red as a player and as an assistant and being the head coach there and roaming the dugout for 41 years. If you could, Mark, just take us through that career path and maybe inside of that, talk to us about what Stanford was, then obviously what you're proud that you built there.
Well, first of all, it's very unusual. I just turned 70 last spring. It's a little scary to believe, but 50 of those, my 70 years on this earth have been at Stanford. I went to Stanford as a recruited football player on football scholarship. I played for John Ralston, and one of the reasons I went to Stanford, they would allow me to play both sports. So I played both baseball and football at Stanford, played for John Ralston, and my position coach in football was Dick Vermeil. Not a bad position coach to have.
Right.
So, it was great. I really enjoyed it. And I really, and then I signed with the White Sox and played in the minor leagues for a couple of years.
Right.
And then, Ray Young, who, was my coach, the head coach, took over for Dutch Ferring, my junior and senior year. He hired me as an assistant when I think I was 23 years old, and I was his assistant, and he went into administration. And it wouldn't happen nowadays, but thanks to Ray Young, he's kind of my mentor as far as the coaching is concerned, and I learned a lot from Ray. And I know if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have been hired as a 28-year-old coach at Stanford as a head coach. I think
right.
he had to convince my athletic director at that time, Joe Rich, that it was a risk worth taking. So I became a head coach thanks to Ray Young, and I learned so much from him. So now the Dutch Ferring, who was a legendary coach and president of ABCA and Hall of Famer, but Dutch was really wanted me to get involved in the ABCA. That was a big thing for him. And I got it. That's how I initially got involved. But also Dutch got me involved in USA baseball.
Right.
And I got involved as assistant coach. And then I became a head coach of, I think, three USA teams. And it was culminated in 1980. I was the Olympic coach in Seoul. So, but I got to thank Dutch Ferring for that. He got me involved. So really to coach 41 years as head coach is really special. And it's special because when you can coach for your alma mater, that is a very special thing. And
that's right.
I really believed in the mission of Stanford University. It's not for everyone, but it's the combination of the excellence, not only number one academically, but also athletically in all the sports. So I was very fortunate to be at Stanford my whole career.
That's certainly a unique place. We're going to dive into some of those details. I want to go back to those first few years as a coach. And Mark, if you could, who were you as a young coach? And if you could just discuss your growth, how you came to really flourish inside that head coaching role, or the lessons that you need to learn that certainly led you off on a better path.
Well, I think as a young coach, and it's even highlighted more today than it was, 40 years ago. You always want to win. I mean, that's good within the rules and doing it the right way. But you always put a value on your success as a coach, as the number of wins and losses you had, or how many guys were in professional baseball or Major League Baseball. And I think as you mature as a coach and you coach longer, you value the educational value that your sport, in this case, baseball, has on your student athletes, because the majority of them aren't going to be major league players. A lot of them will play minor league baseball, maybe if you're in a top program and you get a lot of good players.
Right.
But as you mature as a coach, you say your most important job, really, besides the wins and losses, and everybody wants to win, is the values that you teach your players by playing on a team and competing and doing the things that have a value, an educational value. And the longer you coach, the more you come to appreciate the educational values that playing on an intercollegiate sport, putting the work ethic and everything else comes into play and making them better people, better husbands, better fathers, better everything, teacher, whatever they may be.
Sure.
So I think as you mature as a coach, all of a sudden, you never lose to the competition and wanting to win and set those goals. But I think you come to appreciate the educational value that you instill in your student athletes.
That's a great point. I heard an older coach break down that, a lot of coaches brag about how many players they put in professional baseball. And he said, well, I could sit here and tell you that I've got, over 100 that have played professional baseball. Well, what I'm most proud of is that I've got, 300 that are now husbands, and I've got, the 200
exactly.
more players that are fathers. And, all my players are now productive members of society. And I think that's certainly, was there a point, Mark, maybe that hit you? Can you remember maybe that aha moment where you went, I'm so locked into the next win, the next championship, I got to get really dig deeper into relationships.
Put it this way, and I, because I've coached a long time, I think if you coach long enough, you come to appreciate that. If you only coach 5, 6, 7 years, sometimes you don't get a perspective of it.
That's right.
But when you coach 20 years, 30 years, you have players that come back to you, not star players, maybe guys that you really had a problem with, discipline problems with.
Right.
You had to push them. And they're 35 years old and they have a family and they come back and say, hey coach, I know it was really, I was kind of a pain for you, but I really appreciate everything that you did for me. And I'm coaching my son's little league team now and I'm doing the same things that you did there. And I appreciate it. If you coach long enough at the amateur level, you're going to have players. Obviously the star players are going to thank you for all that stuff, but the players that maybe the backup players, they're going to come thank you. And you say, thank you for what? Coach, you don't know what you did for
That's
me, but
right.
the discipline and the teamwork and the things, the competitive nature that you taught me being on the team really helped me in my job as a teacher, as an engineer, as a salesman or whatever. So I think the longer you coach, the more you come to appreciate and get more thank yous from the players that you didn't realize you were really helping that much. Then all of a sudden it puts in perspective really the value of what you're doing as an amateur coach.
That's outstanding. Let's go back to, and I'm going to try to pull out a few more details on you. We're talking about building that Stanford baseball program. First year as head coach, paint the picture for us of what it looked like, but then go into maybe the details. If I'm a coach listening to this, I really want to know, coach, what's the culture look like? What were the standards you put in place inside your program that helped create Stanford into a household name across college baseball?
Well, I think number one, at the college level, high school, you're limited because the recruiting aspect doesn't come in for the most part.
Sure.
I think as a college coach, you need to know what your niche is. Okay. Mm-hmm. You need to know, it does you no good to spend a lot of time recruiting a certain player when you're going to finish second or third.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
That's
it does
right.
you can't recruit that many. And if you lose enough, you got to know what your niche is.
Mm-hmm.
And every school is different. Cal State Fullerton, for example, it's a tremendous program,
mm-hmm.
had tremendous history. I would bet you that 90% of their players live within 40 miles of Cal State Fullerton.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have so many players, so many junior college, so many outstanding athletes in that area. Whereas at Stanford, my niche is Stanford is national. Over half the kids aren't from California.
Right.
So my niche at Stanford was, number one, they had to be outstanding students academically,
mm-hmm.
Ivy League type students, or I'm wasting my time. And I had to recruit nationally, okay? Because when you combine that academic excellence with athletic excellence, you got to go all over the country. And that also reflects our normal student body.
That's right.
So that was my niche. And Coach Stotts, who was with me, we were together for 37 years, my assistant, Dean Stotts, we recruited nationally. So we'd go all over the country to get mm-hmm. players. You know, Mike Messina, I got him in Turnersville, Pennsylvania. We got them from all over.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to get those players to come to Stanford because of our niche. That's the academics. It may turn a lot of other people off because it's too stringent, but the person that was really a good student, Mike Messina would come all the way across country from Pennsylvania because he wanted that combination of baseball and academics.
That's it.
So that was our niche. But each school has to find out what that niche is, okay, whatever it may be, whether it's a Cal State Fullerton staying more local or whatever, or a school in Texas. I'm not going to leave Texas. I've got enough players here, or whatever it is. Each school has their niche, and the sooner you can find that, the more successful you're going to be and able to attract those top players.
That makes total sense. Were there any team mantras or things that were always on the practice plan or always inside of team meetings or inside your locker room that maybe give us a glimpse as to maybe the pillars or the standards that you had in place specifically for your guys?
One of the things that I think you learn as a young coach, the sooner you learn it, the better is, each coach is different. You have to coach to your personality, okay,
yeah.
Whether that's hang loose, intense. I mean, if you win and you're loose, oh, you win because the kids are relaxed. If you win because you're intense, you win because you're intense. You just have to be yourself.
That's
if you try to be somebody you're not, it just the players see right through it.
Yeah.
So, and they'll accept, they'll adjust. That's part of the educational value that that they learn. You learn to adjust to whoever your head coach is or whoever your employer is. You make that adjustment. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I always, I would be probably considered intense, okay, very, very disciplined, very, I really emphasized the work ethic, okay?
Right.
And one of the things that was critical in the work ethic was to be on time, okay?
Yep.
To be on time, because if a couple guys are late, then it messes up your drill and whatever. So I was big on the work ethic. And I will say this to coaches, and I know it's true. Players will do what you expect them to do, okay? Mm-hmm. They will do what you expect them to do. If you expect them to get passing grades if they want to play, they'll get passing grades. If you expect them to play hard or a certain brand of your style of baseball, they will do that. Now, you might have to continue reinforcing that however mm-hmm. you want to do that. But you have to coach to your personality, and you have to get the things that, for me, the thing was being on time and working hard and competing all the time. Do as many things as you could in practice that involve competition. In our sport, especially in baseball, if you're going to fail 2/3 of the time if you're a hitter. So you've got to learn how to come back and compete and the work ethic and all of those things that it entails. So, but for me, I would say the work ethic, being competitive, and being on time.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, as you know, and I know you and I talked about this last week when we connected, we're talking about just being a continuous learner and, you know, really trusting the process of your growth as a coach if you're continually challenging what you're doing and really thinking through why you do what you do and have a reason for doing that. I'm just wondering, was there something maybe just, you know, as recent as the past season that you looked at it and went, you know what, maybe I could do that differently, or something new that you learned that maybe changed your thoughts or opinions about the way you've done things for years?
No question. I think, especially within the last year, there's so much more emphasis on practice time. You're limited as a older coach and doing anything. You know, in reality, probably we didn't need to practice as many hours as we did before. A lot of times we complain about it, but in reality, you just fine tune it and you can get as much done, if not more. You just tweak your practice plans a little bit.
Sure.
I think I've changed with that. And the other things is that now it's more what kind of shoes you wear, what kind of uniform you wear, this and that.
Yeah.
And really, that doesn't, why let that bother you? If they're doing the things that you want the players to do, the work ethic and the competing and being on time for us and doing everything you can, that's the most important thing. And that's, you don't let the other things affect that part of it. It's not worth worrying about. It really isn't. So the other thing that's changed a little bit, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about later, is a lot of times when you come from showcases or club ball or whatever, versus the emphasis is not as much on winning, okay,
right,
as a team, as it is showcasing your talents. I think that's been more prevalent in recent years. And so one of the things that I've, even though you kind of took it for granted before, one of the things you really have to emphasize now as a coach is to get that talent, that individual talent, combine it with the team and the team winning. And I think that has been a challenge that I need to do specifically on getting players involved in the team aspect as compared to just showcasing their talent for the next thing they want to do, which is pro baseball. So
sure.
Again, the X's and O's, the work ethic and everything, those things haven't changed. You just, some of the periphery stuff, the uniforms and the hair and the meals and all the other stuff that they do, and let's practice on, don't complain about it. It doesn't really affect the outcome anyway.
That's it. I'm going to jump into that. Door, you talked about you got to see the rise of the travel baseball that came inside your career in the game. You knew what it was before, where
yes,
it was, you know, high school and at worst it was Legion teams as your recruiting base, and then
right,
it moved into this travel circuit like you mentioned. Can you just open up your thoughts on what you see, and as you did before, about sometimes those players have a tough time getting back into the team aspect? I know a lot of coaches talk about they lose a little bit of baseball IQ, you know, when you're just out just playing random games, but there isn't the development or the teaching side, or when you come to our program, this is how we run our offense. These are the things that we take as being important to how we have success. How did you combat that, or how did you really bring those guys out of the showcase culture and more back into the Stanford culture?
That's a challenge, and it's become more of a challenge because
right,
in reality, the focus is for those outstanding, and obviously at our level, we're dealing with elite high school players that
that's right,
are probably going to get drafted or have been drafted and don't sign and come to college. And they're playing for a club team and they're playing for good coaches, or maybe they have a hitting instructor or a pitching mm-hmm. instructor that have really helped them. So One of the things that I try to emphasize is, I don't care how you hit or how you pitch. If it works for you, fine. Okay. Just take that talent level and whatever you're going to, as a hitter or as a pitcher, and have it come into the team aspect. Do what you need to do to help the team win offensively, defensively, pitching wise, whatever, and be a part of that team. And sometimes that takes a while, but really, if you have a couple of older players on the team, maybe juniors or seniors that are already in your program and know that and very team, they can help you bring that freshman involved in your program.
That's true.
What you talk about, the culture,
yeah,
not just of winning, but which helps, but how we play. And each program can be different. This is how Coach Mark was coaches. He may be a little intense, but he's fine. He'll do this. Or Coach Smith, he's really hang loose, but he's really good. You need your older players to help get those freshmen used to the culture that you have in your particular program, which is focused on getting the team to play together and to win. Also in our business, it's also to take care of business off the field. Mm-hmm. Obviously, how you handle yourself off the field, not getting yourself in trouble. But just as important, make sure you're taking care of business in the classroom. Okay?
That's it.
Don't focus on, I'm going to be a major league player and I don't care about class. I just want to get drafted. I mean, and sometimes that's a hard sell because they're so focused on that. And that comes from the club baseball focuses on one thing, getting a scholarship and being a professional baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the issue. Okay. And you play it. And another thing that concerns me sometimes if you're identified as a great pitcher, you start playing baseball 12 months a year at age 12.
Yeah.
Maybe you're a great basketball player, football player, whatever.
Sure.
So you just don't know. And I've always felt that I would prefer my baseball players I recruit that played another sport,
yep,
football or basketball or track or whatever. I like those guys to play other sports. I use the example of John Elway, who I helped recruit. He was going to be an NFL quarterback. He's out of L.A., Southern California, and best quarterback in the land. And everybody knew that he chose Stanford, and he was going to be an NFL quarterback. But John Elway wanted to play baseball.
Mm-hmm.
He played baseball in high school, played 2 years at Stanford. He'd scrimmage when you could. The rules were allowed. He'd scrimmage in the morning and come play in the game in the afternoon. But he's an athlete that
sure
wanted to compete.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're getting away from that. Too specialized to a certain extent. I would prefer, there's plenty of time to specialize. It used to be not unusual to have a two sport athlete in high school or a three sport.
Mm-hmm.
That's rare now.
Yeah.
That's rare.
I think it's coming
back,
though.
Shame.
Yeah. I do think,
I
think there's a concern for safety. There's a concern for arm care, the overall health of the player. That's coming back. And I think more coaches, Mark, are really starting to get that more back into the culture where it was play every sport, then it got to specialization. It seems like we're roller coaster riding it back towards play multiple sports, let your arm breathe for a few months, take off November through, January, and then come back and play your high school, your travel season. I think more guys are buying into that.
The other thing that happens is it has an effect on other players in your sport.
Mm-hmm.
A good example, 100 years ago when I played high school baseball, you had Legion teams, or Connie Mack. We had Legion teams.
Right.
And the Legion team was based on all the players from that particular high school, or maybe two high schools if the enrollment wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
So you played, and you played good competition, and everybody, your guys on your high school team, they played summer baseball in American Legion. That doesn't happen anymore because the club teams takes the best two players or three players from the best high schools in the area, and then the average player doesn't have a team to play on.
That's right.
they're not playing anymore.
Yeah.
It's just the elite players are all playing in clubs, and they travel all over the country, which is fine. It's great competition, but it leaves a lot of the players no place to play. The average player, the good high school player, but maybe not a recruited college player. He doesn't play baseball anymore, or mm-hmm. very limited. So I think that has been a drawback to the club thing, and there's nothing wrong with it. The better competition, but that's one of the things that's sad. And also, I noticed when I talk to a lot of the coaches in volleyball or softball at the college level, they don't recruit on the high school level anymore.
Right.
They go to club teams.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, some sports say don't play high school sport. Just play club.
Mm-hmm.
That's sad.
Yeah, it is.
That's sad.
Yeah. And I know a lot of outcry from high school coaches as we are the guys that probably know our players the best, and that we know what that kid looks like in the hallways. We know who he is in the classroom. Yep. We know, you know, who he hangs out with yep. outside, and where the travel coach has that guy during the summer. And it's not one or the other, but I think there is I will stand up for the high school coaches that are listening to this show, as, you know, I think as college coaches, if you are recruiting, you definitely have to pay homage to that high school coach and find out what he thinks, as opposed to just watching summer games and going, man, that's the best kid on the field. That kid's going to come in and change your culture one way or another, and I would hope that you would do your homework to make sure he changes it positively.
Well, and the other thing is that high school coach is also an educator.
That's right.
Okay? It doesn't mean, you know what I mean? I mean, he's probably teaching, he could be teaching PE, but more likely he's taking history or math or something, mm-hmm. and he knows about that student academically, knows about how he handles himself off the field and in the classroom, and those are big parts of the puzzle.
That's
and
right.
And you need that. And heaven forbid if we don't have that input from the high school coaches, that gives it's a shame if you don't even go to the high school coach anymore. You know what I mean?
That's
you
right.
Go to the showcase and recruit from there. That's hopefully we don't get away from that.
That's a great point. I want to come back to something, and I think I know where we'll go with this, but if you could go back to why you coached, and that seems to come up so much on our podcast and talking with our great coaches, if you can define your why. So what was driving you each and every year in the dugout? What meant the most to you about being able to be a lifelong baseball coach?
Well, I think it gets down to initially, and I think you mature into that. When I look at myself as from the age of 7 or 8, it's always been about playing sports.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I did as well as I could in academically because my parents went in. But really, it's that sport. And for me, it was all three sports. I loved to play. I loved the competition. Okay, I was always playing a sport. When I went to Stanford, I was always in season. I was football season. I was in baseball season.
Mm-hmm.
The summer baseball. I was always competing. And I think for me, and I think it has to do with a lot of athletes, if you can't play anymore and can't compete as an athlete, the next best thing is to compete in a sport that you love
mm-hmm.
and compete as a coach and also get paid for it if you could.
That's okay? Right.
I think most coaches that coach would do it even if they weren't getting paid. Their wife wouldn't appreciate it.
That's
but
right.
I think it gets back to the competition.
Yeah.
Okay. And all coaches are that way. They want to compete and they want to win. And the majority of coaches, and we help with that with the ABCA and, mm-hmm. and doing it ethically and doing the right things, okay, which 99% of them are doing that and teaching the values that we want our young people to learn. But it's all about competition. And then as you mature as a coach and you see the value that coaching aspect of it, the competition is part of that. The winning and losing is part of that,
mm-hmm.
okay? When you lose the feeling that, oh, I lost, it doesn't bother you, you need to get out of coaching.
Yeah.
You can't do it. You can't
right.
put the time in it. But you have an appreciation. Hey, we didn't have a great winning season, but the kids, they worked hard and whatever. And that experience they have playing their collegiate athletics or baseball in our particular case is going to help them the rest of their lives. So I think initially and to this day, you know, it really has to do about competing and competing at the highest level. And that's why I went into coaching.
That's awesome. Now, I'm guessing it was baseball, basketball, and football. Those are your three sports you played?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I want to let
exactly.
you know, a couple months ago, we had Mike Martin on from Florida State. Now, he referenced that he played basketball and thought he was pretty good. So I guess I'm going to, if I had this this magic wand, if I brought together a young Mark Marquis and a young Mike Martin, who would win on the hoops court?
On the hoops court?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
And I'll report back to 11. Let you know. Let them know what he said.
Well, I thought I was a pretty good quarterback. I was recruited as a quarterback, but some guy named Jim Plunkett ended up at Stanford, and I went to the defense right away. So I was a safety. So all of us, you know, one thing you don't do at Stanford, you don't brag about anything, because as soon as you brag about something, someone just say, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" You know?
That's right.
But Plunkett wasn't a bad quarterback. So
yeah, he
was
okay.
I went to the defense right away.
That's awesome. Let's go dive inside your coaching career. And we always talk about highs and lows. Obviously, the high moments that still bring a smile to your face, but there's also some lows. And I think what we gain from those lows, Coach Marquis, is when we talk about what got you through those. So can you open that up for our guys?
Sure. There are always, you know, when you lose, it's a low. Okay, but when you at the end of the season, you reflect on it. Probably the hardest season for me was 2 years ago. I mean, in 2015, I had two losing seasons in 41 years.
Yeah.
And one of those losing seasons, we were one game under 500. But in 2015, we had Mike Messina, a guy named John Hostetter, and Marcus Brakeman was our starters. And we opened the season and did really well. We're at Fullerton and beat Fullerton 2 out of 3. And it was fantastic. We went to Rice and I lost all 3 starting pitchers.
Oh, wow.
And my shortstop and I only had 11 guys. Okay. Cal Quantrill was a pitcher. Cal Quantrill was the first time got hurt. Cal Quantrill, my 3 starting pitchers got hurt at Rice. My shortstop, my 3rd baseman were hurt.
Mm.
And all 3 pitchers were out for the whole year. And so we really struggled. Okay. It was the easiest time I had to make out a lineup because I had only had 11 guys.
Right.
who were going to live. But it was a real challenge, okay,
mm-hmm.
to get those players that I had that were healthy to keep working hard, to get better. And we were able to do that, as crazy as it sounds. I thought for sure we were gonna finish last. We finished 10th out of 11 and really kind of played our best baseball at the end. And I think that was the toughest part because the expectation level was such that it never happened to us before.
Right.
And I really had to challenge myself and my assistants, how are we going to keep these guys competing? You know, and it happens. And a lot of times as coaches, you can't use the injuries as an excuse because it happens to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the biggest challenge to me, especially Cal Quantrill, who was tremendous, going to be, you know, a first round draft pick and really had pitched for us as a freshman and got us one game away from the World Series. Losing him was critical, and he had Tommy John surgery and all that. But again, that was probably the most challenging coaching job of my career.
Hmm.
As far as the highlight, it would be 87. We won our first national championship.
Yeah.
And then my involvement in USA baseball, another highlight was in 88 when we won the gold medal in Seoul, Korea.
Yeah.
So those are the low part in 2015 season. I think when we were 24 and 32 or whatever the heck we were. And then 87, the first national championship. And then in 88, we won a national championship in 88. Also, that was obviously a thrill, but the gold medal was really special because that happens once in your life, you know.
That's it. Absolutely. I was talking with Coach Garrido about this. I want to throw this question to you. When you do win a national championship, like you did in 87, did you find in 88 that might have been one of your toughest years to really have the national championship looming over that season, and how are you going to prepare for it that season?
I think Augie's great with that. I think that's true.
Right.
But in my case, in 88, we were nowhere near as good a team. No, nowhere near as good. But we had been there before.
Right.
And that was Messina's freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had a guy named Mike Messina and Stan Spencer, who were freshmen and really matured. We had still Ed Sprague, you know, was a great, great player. But the advantage we have is the regionals. We went to a regional in Maine, and it wasn't new to us. The problem you have when you go to Omaha the first time is everything's so different, so much more media. You get
right.
hyped up in all the other things.
Yeah.
We weren't nearly as good, but we were experienced. We know what to expect. And then the two freshman pitchers come on and pitch lights out, and we nowhere near as good as 80s. No, probably the weakest team I took the College World Series
wow.
was 88. But they had been there before, and we played well, and those freshman pitchers really came through. So it was just the opposite. So, you know, and that happens sometimes. Sometimes
sure.
when you go to Omaha, and I know that Mike Martin can reflect on this, and, mm-hmm. and Augie certainly can, sometimes your best team doesn't win it.
That's
doesn't
right.
play well.
That's right.
It's just playing, you know, it's different in the World Series now. The guy that, when you win it, is the guy that, the average guy that has goes crazy for 6 or 7 games.
It.
And I think
that's it.
That normally happens to the team that wins the College World Series.
Mm.
Okay. And sometimes the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
It's that unexpected player that really performs well.
That's a great point. Even Kevin O'Sullivan was on our show a couple months ago, and he made that. We've had some really great teams of Florida, and this might have been, if I had to stack them up, wasn't as talented, but they got hot
yep.
at the right time. They played the right baseball at the right time, and it all worked out.
And their guys had been there before.
That's it, 100%.
Know, a lot of guys had been there before.
Tremendous point. Take us inside. Pull the curtain back, Mark. All right? Give me hidden talents or hobbies. What do you do now? What do you do to keep your time?
I don't have any hobbies. My hobbies as a coach were make sure I did what my wife told me, and I had 3 daughters, and make sure I went to their games or their teachers' meetings and everything else. So
sure.
I didn't have many hobbies as a coach. I'm trying to play golf now, but if I keep, I think I'd be I'd be better if the ball was moving in golf. And if I keep playing golf like I am, I'm going to have to go back and coach or wander the streets or something. So I've been really busy now because I have 9 grandchildren, and my youngest daughter, who has 3 young kids, are in New York. So I was back there for a couple of weeks in the summer, and I've been doing a lot of things with my wife, and we've traveled a little bit. So, but again, I'm trying to, I've never been able to play golf, and I always told my friends, I'll start playing golf when I get old. Well, I'm old, and this golf thing's a lot tougher than I thought it would be.
So you were more of the celebrity at the golf scramble more than you were jumping in a foursome.
And actually, I never played really. I'd ride around with them and talk and but sure. I was god awful. I still am god awful, but I'm hopeful that I'll get better. I am hopeful, Jeremy, but I'm not sure of that.
We're pulling for you. tell me.
Now, I'll tell you the guy that can golf is Mike Martin.
Yes, he can.
He's scary good.
See, and here's the inner details. So Mike Martin and I did our podcast as he was coming back from playing 18 holes. We talked in his truck as he drove back from playing 18 holes. They say he can really, really play.
Well, I used to play Mike a lot. We used to play a lot. And one time I went to play Mike, and how's it going? He was going to play at Augusta. He got somebody to get him on Augusta. Sure. That's all he could talk about the whole series. After this series, Mark, I'm going to go play Augusta. He's a tremendous, tremendous golfer. I know that from Mike. People to play with Mike.
Open up some funny stories for us. That's always a question we love talking about, like things that just happened that only your team would certainly know on the bus or in the dugout or in the hotel. But what are some stories, or maybe dealing with an umpire? Give us some of the funny stories that happened to you over the years.
You mentioned that to me before. I'm starting to think, there was, you talk about the bus trips and if you coach in college, you're taking a bus trip, you mm-hmm. take planes, but a lot of times it's 3 hours away, 4 hours, you're taking a bus. It's just fast to take a bus and fly. So, I'll never forget one that we were, when you go from Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area down to LA, which mm-hmm. we would sometimes, especially after 9/11, we'd take a bus, you know, because of such a hassle in and out of the airports. But anyway, we were down there, and we it's on Highway 5, and there's nothing on
nothing.
Highway 5. You just go. I mean, that's the fastest way down there, all the trucks. And there's a place, a truck stop with a lot of places to eat and stuff, and we would always stop there on the way back, coming back from playing SC or whatever the heck we were playing. And we stopped, which is about 2 hours after you get out of L.A., and we stop and get in the bus and get on, and we just go. And all of a sudden, we didn't have cell phones at those times, in those days. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden said, "Hey, Coach, Mendez is not here." I said, "What?" "Mendez isn't on the bus." And we're an hour down the road.
Sure. Gone.
I left the player at a truck stop in the middle of nowhere. So we got the bus driver to drive all the way back, and we picked him up. And I never lived that down.
Yeah.
From that day on, people go, "Why do you always call the names of the players every time we get back on the bus?" Because I didn't want to lose one. But
been there, done that.
Nowadays, they would call you, "Hey, Coach, you left me behind. What happened?" Right. And then the other one was, which is, I'll never forget this one, is, as I mentioned to you before, I've been a really stickler on being on time and being a practice on time and, you know, all of that. And so, again, we're playing down in Southern California or wherever. We're on a bus. It could have been a flight, but we get back to Stanford. We probably get back to about 12:15 at night. Not too bad, but mm-hmm. we go back to the locker room and put their stuff in, and they go back to the dorms. And I had a player by the name of Mike Doherty. Mike was a talented football player, baseball player, talent, has played for the Raiders, has a Super Bowl ring, just a great, but a character.
Sure.
Crazy. Not bad way, just a character.
Absolutely.
So we get back, and I tell on the bus, I said, get off. I said, "Okay, guys, practice tomorrow at 3:00. So I get out of practice, and my daughter isn't there. What the heck is that crazy guy doing? "Hey, Mike, you come here to the field. I know where you are. Give him the field." So he comes to the field. I got all the players around me. I said, "Hey, Dot," I said, "what's going on here? You didn't show up for practice." He says, "Well, Coach, you said practice tomorrow, and it was 12:15. So I knew we had the day off."
Of course he did. Well, and again, I'm sure that changed you as well. I'm sure you were very literal when you told him when practice was.
Yeah, the next day. And he was right. It wasn't the same day, 12:15. So whatever. But anyway, hopefully I never left any more players behind at a truck stop after that anyway.
That's it. Overcome and adjust. Just figure it out as you go. Open up this question. I love this one because certainly you've been influenced on so many and you've referenced a few. But we talk about your personal Mount Rushmore. If you could really put three or four people up on your pedestal, who are the three or four that really impacted you the most throughout coaching?
Dutch Ferring. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I played for Dutch 1 year and he was a real gentleman. A gentleman coach, Hall of Fame coach, obviously, but his passion was to get baseball into the Olympics.
Yeah.
Okay. And he did that. He achieved that. Marty Caroll. There's a lot of other old time coaches, Rod Dato, a lot of one, but Dutch was a driving force. And, he got me involved in the ABCA, right, as an assistant coach. Yeah. But just as important, he got me involved in USA Baseball for so many years. And no question, Dutch has to be one. And then Ray Young, who I played for, he was my mentor. Mm-hmm. And because of him, I became a baseball coach, worked for him for 5 years. And I wouldn't have been a head coach at Stanford without Ray Young and his help and advice. And I always relied on Ray. Tremendous. Just saw him last year. He came out. He lives in New Zealand now where his daughter is and his grandkids. But just a great baseball guy, work ethic. And I would probably say of the coaches that I played for in two sports, I think Dick Vermeil was a really a tremendous coach, different sport. But his work ethic and, I mean, you would say, God, you'd say to Coach Vermeil, it's never good enough. It's never good enough for you. And that's what makes you great.
Sure.
He would push you again and you'd run through a wall for the guy, but he's demanded you to give it your most. And again, like I said, for whatever reason, at that time, freshmen didn't play varsity and he was a head coach of the freshman team and whatever position he coached, I played under him at Stanford, but he was a tremendous coach. And if you talk to players that played for Coach Vermeil, they loved the guy and he was, I learned a lot from him, but those are three guys really had an impact on me.
That's outstanding. It just kind of hit me a little bit off script, but who did you really enjoy competing against? If you looked at your schedule each and every year and just those games you really enjoyed competing against.
Well, again, there's so many great coaches. Augie Garrido, Augie and I played on an amateur team 100 years ago, and I've known Augie for 50 years, and so I always pull up playing Augie. The great thing about Augie, a great coach, but it was always up front. Everything was great. You competed, no excuses, no behind the scenes stuff. I love playing against Augie, and I always played Augie. But yeah. Started San Francisco State, Cal Poly, Fullerton. I didn't go to Illinois when it's Illinois. It's too darn cold there.
That's but, right. That's why he left there, too. Okay.
So I love playing Augie, right. and it's great because if you find out how where your weaknesses were, because if you had any weaknesses, Augie would find them and you'd get beat. Love Mike Martin. Pleased to play Mike. We have played Mike for a number of years. It's I really enjoy it. A lot of times I didn't like to play people I knew personally. Dave Esker, who I coached and was at Cal. I hated to play Cal when I coached against Dave. And now he's taking my job at Stanford, taking over for me, and he's going to do a great job. And so, Mike Gillespie, I don't like to play Mike. I like to play Mike, but he's such a good day, but I never liked to play him. After I left SC, I never played him with Irvine because he's too good a friend of mine. Yeah, so, yeah. But again, and Rod Dato, I coached it when I first started. I played against Rod Dato, and he had great talent. But I'll tell you one thing: I can say about Rod, he had better talent than anybody else, and he would win a lot of games. But he knew when to get a pitcher out, when to stay with him, whatever. He was really a master of really controlling the pitching staff, which it probably is the most important role a coach or a manager has, and you know when to make that pitching change. And Rod Dato, Art Reichel, George Wolfman from Cal. I mean, we're talking about guys. You know, I've coached long enough that are just really special, special people. And the thing that's different now, Jeremy, which is sad to a certain extent, to a great extent, is the longevity of coaches at the colleges is not what it used to be.
Right.
You know, there's so much more of a turnover now than there used to. You know, I mean, it was unusual to coach at a college for 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. You know, not that unusual. Nowadays, it's unusual.
Yeah, that's right.
Unusual.
Hmm.
you know, much more competitive. They pay coaches more nowadays, but it's not the same. It's a little bit different. You go, it's not like it used to be, but that's unfortunate because I was at a time that all those coaches I mentioned, they'd been at those schools for 25, 30 years.
That's right.
You know, so
that's right.
It's different. It's different now. But anyway, you always want to compete. It's harder to compete against some of your good friends, but you do that. You compete. You want to do the best, and that's what makes it nice about sport is that competition. And
that's
then
awesome.
You know, shake hands afterwards and be a good friend and everything. So,
100%.
But like you said, I don't tell them what my signs are. Sure, that's not my signs.
Everything but that. That's all. You don't get it all. All right, here's the last question, Coach. You've been so forthright with your time, and you and I have really had a great time connecting and talking through a lot of different points, but when we get a guy on like you that's got so much perspective that you can offer and just your viewpoint is going to mean so much to our guys listening in. If you could you give them some advice if they're paying attention to the show? What's some things that you think might set them off on a different path and really enjoy their time in coaching?
The number one thing is to remind them that really as an amateur coach, okay, the most important thing that they're going to teach their players, besides how to hit, how to throw, how to slide, okay, are have an appreciation for the hard work and dedication they have to their sports
mm-hmm.
and what they do. The being competitive, but the work ethic, the being part of a team, helping the team, be a team player, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the values, educational values that they're going to learn, whether you realize it or not as a coach. They're learning that, and they have an appreciation for that. No question. It's really no different than being a parent, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. Sometimes it's got to be tough love to a certain extent, certain things. Some are harder to coach than others, but there's an appreciation for that, and they have an appreciation for it. That's the number one thing. Don't neglect that. And the other thing is, if you're a high school coach or a college coach, you don't forget academics.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that athletic. You can use that as a motivator to do well in the classroom. I'm going to tell you something. If you tell a player, if you don't pass this course or you don't get a B in this course, you're not going to play. They're going to pass that course. You can be a motivator. Okay. They'll do what you, as I tell you, the players will do what you expect them to do. You need to reinforce that, but reinforce the work ethic, the competition, the academics, the baseball will take care of itself. And we have too many great coaches out there that can, the X's and O's are the easy part. It's the other things. And I approach it, can you be your player's best friend? Maybe you can. That's great. But can you be your son or daughter's best friend? Times you can't be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you say, you can't do this to my daughter. I think you got to remember that. I think it's no different than if you have children, how you raise your children and the value system that you put on the sport. We're lucky because we have sport can teach so much to young people.
That's right.
Okay. And we're not even talking about wins and losses or batting average or everything else. And I think the longer you do that, one of the things that you mentioned to me and the highlight of my career, 46 years of coaching, was last February. When they had my retirement thing for me surprised me.
Yeah.
I had players from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s come. I had 150 players show up for that.
Yeah.
Okay. And those weren't major league players. They had some. Okay. And that's the highlight of my career because that's the value of coaching.
Mm.
And high school coaches and college coaches, you will experience that same thing. And that is very worthwhile. Very worthwhile, and it makes it all worth it. So really, that one day with that many players coming back and thanking me, okay, made what I've done for my career, that made it all worthwhile. No different than a great teacher or whatever it is. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But that is really the highlight, and I think coaches need to realize, number one, you're a coach, but you're an educator first.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make, you know, it's not all a professional coach, but that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Coaches at the high school and college, you're educators. You're coaches too, but number one, you're educators. Everything that means. And we all have really special teachers that we'll never forget. And a lot of coaches, a lot of players feel that way about their coaches. And that's special.
It's awesome. Coach Marquis, thank you so much for jumping on the call with us. I think anytime we can go extra innings with a guy that's got so much to offer, we've got to take advantage of that. So I'm just thankful we carved out the time for it. Again, on behalf of the national office, but also all the coaches inside the ABCA, congrats again on your Ethics and Coaching Award. We look forward to seeing you in Indianapolis, my man, and thanks for jumping on the call with us again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Anytime I can do anything for you, let me know. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks.
Take care of that family.
Oh, yeah. I did it to you. Little MJ for the outro. I'm doing the Thriller dance behind the mic right now. No big deal. But how awesome was that, coaches? Connecting with a living legend in Coach Mark Marquis from Stanford University. And it's so great to hear how one of the very best, an ABCA Hall of Famer, approached developing his players and his teams. How impactful those relationships were to him then and are still his most prized possessions even now. We can absolutely never get enough of that message, guys. Wins and championships, they take care of themselves when your players and that relationship are the focus. They are the driving force behind our why to keep coaching. Just awesome. Thanks again, Coach Marquis, for your time and your contributions to the game. Congrats on your Ethics and Coaching Award as we look forward to seeing you in Indianapolis this January. Now, we hope you're making plans yourself for Indy and bring your staff, come invest in your development as a coach. There will be no better opportunity each and every year than to join us at our annual convention. Head over to abca.org. If you click on membership, you'll see all the great things we're doing for our coaches around the world, but then click on events. Our hotel and transportation information is there. Plus, you can open yourself up to an extensive list of activities that's waiting for each of you guys in Indy. January 4th through the 7th, 4 days of baseball heaven, one of the very best lineups of main stage speakers we've had to date. Our expo theater inside our trade show will be another great spot to learn and develop from. Plus, we're unveiling a brand new lineup for our youth clinics on Saturday, January 6th. If you're a youth age coach, come to our show. You will be blown away at what we've got in store for you, plus much, much more that goes way beyond that website. It's a can't-miss opportunity, coaches. If you have any questions at all, please never hesitate to reach out to us. Make sure you're following us there on Twitter, at ABCA1945. You can find me as well on there, at CoachSheets3. You can always reach me directly by email, Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. Always keep this in mind, guys. We work for you. Our coaches who are ABCA members, you guys are our bosses. And if we can help you out, answer any questions, point you in the right direction, please let us know. We always have your back across every single front. And if you truly enjoyed this particular podcast or any of the shows you've listened into, please take a minute and share our podcast with the baseball folks that you have access to. Could be other coaches on your staff, could be other coaches in your conference or your region. What about the youth or the high school coaches in your area? Guys, what about your players? Those are the perfect targets for these podcasts. Connect them with the best baseball minds in this game. Plus, just keep sharing the show, guys. The more we keep doing it, it's amazing to watch how we're all growing the game just by sharing resources and just by taking an interest in those around us. That is the beauty of the baseball community, guys. Send them the link to iTunes. It'll show up on their phone each and every Tuesday. You could also send them to abca.org/podcast. They can subscribe from there. And also make sure they get us on Twitter at ABCA1945. And as always, thank you for spreading the great word about what we're doing for baseball. A few things real quick I want to make sure you're aware of. Our hashtag ABCA chat is tonight, Tuesday, October 31st, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Come inside, drop off the bags of candy. We're talking hitting from last week's episode with the Rockies AAA hitting coach and loyal ABCA member, Darren Everson, and we will jump on there with coaches from all over to ask questions while they respond with their insight, resources, videos, etc., all to help connect coaches and network while helping our coaches challenge what they're teaching even inside their home programs. It's awesome, so we hope you make time to join us. Check out our hashtag ABCA chat on Twitter. Plus, our Barnstormers Clinics Tour, it keeps rolling, but the end is in sight. We've got Nashville and Memphis. They're in our crosshairs. We're going to be at Lipscomb University and the University of Memphis next weekend. Plus, we've got Duke University and the University of South Carolina as our last few events of this year's fall tour. We've got 16 down in the hopper. We've got four more to go. So come join us at the ballpark for our one-day coaching clinics from the very best teacher professionals in these areas, moving everybody towards Indianapolis this January. For more information, head over to abca.org/clinics. Jump on the Barnstormers tour bus with us. And lastly, remember, this is the podcast for the American Baseball Coaches Association, and we appreciate what each of you are doing out there to teach this great game. You're impacting young people's lives and always staying hungry and driven for more baseball knowledge. I'll tell you what, if you keep listening, we'll keep getting these out there for you. And as always, thank you for listening in, staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. And until next week, guys, keep growing, keep developing, keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball. Ha 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 ha